Coming up next on the Radio Zine, KBOO programmer Robin Shanti speaks with David Corton, author of the best-selling When Corporations Rule the World. He'll be discussing the ideas in his new book, The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community.
This is Robin Shanti, and I'm speaking with David Corton. David's a former Harvard Business School professor. He has more than 30 years of hands-on experience living and working in Africa, Latin America, and Asia, and he's authored numerous books, including When Corporations Rule the World and The Post-Corporate World, Life After Capitalism. He is the co-founder and board chair of the Positive Futures Network, publishers of Yes Magazine, and he serves on the board of the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. He has a brand new book out, a very groundbreaking book, I might add, called The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community. And David will be appearing here in Portland on Thursday, May 25th at the First Unitarian Church, 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue. David, we're delighted to have you here on KBOO.
Well, it's my privilege to be on your show.
Well, David, let's start with the basic premise of the book. I know you've taken and added to the work of Rianne Eisler, who has come up with a powerful paradigm understanding human history, and putting them into sort of two categories rather than sort of patriarchies and matriarchies. She had coined the terms dominator cultures and partnership cultures. Can you talk about what the Great Turning is and how those ideas relate to the work you've done in your book?
Yes. Well, what Rianne laid out, of course, with that distinction are the two primary ways in which we humans can organize our relationships, both with ourselves, among ourselves, and between ourselves and Earth. And she observed through her historical and archaeological research that some 5,000 years ago, our ancestors took a turn from more partnership, more egalitarian, gender-balanced ways of organizing to organizing by systems of domination at all levels, from relations among states to relations among people, individuals and family members. And we have been in that mode essentially ever since. It creates a terrible, destructive dynamic of pitting every person in competition with every other, and resulting in the diversion of much of the resources of human societies away from meeting the needs of people to maintaining the systems of domination. Of course, the most obvious example is military forces. Now, the thesis of the book is that we've come to reach the limits of the exploitation that both people and planet will sustain, and that we must make a new turning away from the frameworks of what I call empire dominator systems to the partnership relations of Earth community. So the book is about tracing the history of how we got ourselves into this situation and what we need to do to get out of it.
Can you talk about some of those myths that empire is based on?
Yes, I mean, you know, you look at all of this in the large context of human history and the human experience, and you see that it's been a horrendously costly way of organizing. And among other things, one of the things I realized I went through history is that every empire in the human experience has been based on a foundation of slavery or its equivalents. And you come to realize it's quite axiomatic that if you're going to have a system with a few people on top, most people will be on the bottom. And that means that, they're denied their rights. Their creative potential is permanently suppressed. Now, you then ask the question of how does that happen? Why do people submit to this over so many thousands of years? and you come to an analysis of, you know, how our institutional structures support that suppression, but also how it's built into our cultures and the stories that the storytellers of empire communicate out into the society. Now it becomes particularly evident in our time. You know, right at this moment, we're caught up in a particular period in which a group of what I refer to as right-wing extremists, who are totally committed to converting our society, well, not converting it, but to strengthening the systems of elite rule in our own time and creating economic relations that concentrate the wealth of the society in the hands of a very few people. Now, how is it that they've been able to do that? And one is through stories that define how we think about what is prosperity and how do we achieve it, how we achieve security and how we find meaning. Now, this becomes kind of a key to decoding the political discourse of our time, and of course, you and I are particularly interested in the issues of economic relationships and what our economic choices and alternatives are. So one of the great myths of our time is that prosperity is achieved through economic growth.
And tax cuts for the rich.
Part of that story is that to have economic growth, you have to have it comes from investment. Investment requires wealthy people, and so to have the maximum growth, you have to eliminate taxes on the rich and eliminate the regulations that constrain their ability to amass great fortunes to then invest and create jobs. Of course, another piece of that myth is that we need to eliminate any kind of welfare programs or social safety nets that might reduce the incentive of the poor to take whatever jobs are offered at whatever wages the market offers. So that's one of the myths of our time and a story that that we hear constantly repeated.
Well, wouldn't a myth also that we're living in right now be around security? You know, there's a terrorist around every every lamppost, and the fear mongering that is being done to keep people kind of paralyzed.
Yes, that of course is another piece of it that's particularly prevalent at this moment in time. That we're told that our security is threatened by terrorists, criminals, and so forth, and that. That the response to this is more military power, military domination of any nation or people that pose a presumed threat. Of course, it's also part of that story is that the way that we deal with criminals that threaten us also is to build ever stronger police forces, build bigger jails and put more people in prison. So all of these stories come around to reinforcing the idea that we need to be ruled by a strong elite that is able to impose order and not incidentally impose its own will on the society through coercive force.
Well, if we're using the term stories or myths, are really the control of information, when more and more information is being controlled by fewer and fewer corporations, how can we get alternative stories, the stories that would build Earth community, how can they supersede the imperial story?
Well, first of all, through our interpersonal communications, I've always... I've long been struck that in the time of the fall of colonial empires, I think India is one of the great examples that the revolution that that Gandhi led against British rule. Of course, the British controlled the media. Gandhi didn't have the advantage of the internet, but the stories and the communication traveled essentially person to person. Now, of course, we have the internet. We have so many different modes of electronic and print publication that are difficult to control. I think one of the causes that I'm very committed to is the idea of helping people recognize the distinction between corporate media, which, of course, is controlled by a few large corporations. We've come to think of this as the mainstream media, but that's the wrong term. It's the corporate media, which uses that media essentially to maintain the myths of empire. Our fortunate side, our hope lies in the fact that we're increasingly developing a whole range of independent media, both in print and on the airways. Of course, my own work connected to Yes Magazine as a print publication devoted to telling positive stories. And then, of course, we have the internet and stations like Cable, which operate as, not to maximize profit and get out the corporate advertising and political messages, but rather to give reach to authentic voices that are really trying to understand the realities of our society, the real nature of our human possibilities, and break through that barrier to a larger understanding, and break through the hegemony of the corporate stories and myths.
And if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with David Corton, the author of The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community, and he'll be appearing at the First Unitarian Church tomorrow night, May 25th at 7:30 p.m., and the First Unitarian Church is located at 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue, downtown. And David, can you also talk about when you use the phrase the Great Turning? And in your book, you mentioned that there are three turnings that are kind of the major spheres of human activity, and that we have to turn from dominator to partnership frameworks in each of these areas, culturally, economically, and politically.
Yes, well, this frame actually comes from from a good colleague of mine from the Philippines, Nicanor Perlis, who points out that each of these spheres of human activity has its own foundations of power. Of course, the political power of the state is based on its capacity to use legitimate physical force. Power of the economic sphere is essentially the power of money and the power of ownership of productive assets and technology. The cultural sphere is the sphere of values, and the stories by which we define our values, define what it means to be human, define our possibilities. Now, the interesting thing that I learned from Nikki is the idea that ultimately the cultural power is the defining power. That if you can control the stories, the stories by which we shape our values, then that determines what use of political and economic power is considered legitimate by the society. Now, Nikki also points out that cultural power and the power of values is the natural realm of civil society, of citizen groups, that authentic cultures flow up from the exchanges among people, from life and community. And ultimately, if we citizens are to regain control of our political and economic institutions, it will be through redefining the stories by which we define our cultural values. And I think this, to me, that becomes quite a startling insight, because we all have the power of our voice. Each of us has a role to play in the redefining of the stories by which we define how we live. Now, one of the things we need to talk a little bit about here is what is the alternative to the dominator stories of empire that we just talked about.
Absolutely.
And the thing that's so stunning to me is that the alternative story centers in community and rebuilding the relationship, the caring relationships of community. And that ultimately community is the foundation of prosperity. It is also the foundation of security. Because if you have strong communities, then people pull together in times of crisis and times of need. And through mutual caring and sharing of available resources, we each end up having more and having much greater security in our lives.
Now, I know that the myth or the story, the prevailing story, is anything but that. So the average person who grows up in this country, a citizen of this empire, very rarely sees that. I mean, people here in Portland, maybe in the Northwest, we call it sometimes our progressive bubble because it's so different, you know, than other parts of the country. How can we demythologize? I don't know what the correct word would be. You said, you know, sharing these stories, but when the very institutions reinforce this mythology over and over and over again, what tools do we have while we're still participating in those institutions to hasten the great turning?
Well, I mean, of course, I very much honor the fact that that Portland is a remarkable example. In my experience, I've come to think in terms of their important centers of new energy emerging across the United States, and of course, Portland is one of them. And your wonderful success in creating a city that, at least compared to other cities, is just an extraordinary place to live. And of course that has come about through people joining in common cause to say that, you know, just allowing corporations and individuals to dictate how we live based on what is going to make the most money for them in the short term is horribly destructive, and that we need to get together and think about how we use our land, our space, and how we set our economic priorities and so forth in relation to the needs of the community. Now, I think that sort of thing that kind of viewpoint is emerging all across the country. And of course, you're very much involved in the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, of which you have a very strong chapter there in Portland. And I think that organization, I guess, only about 4 years old now, 4 or 5 years old.
Nope, three.
Three.
We wish it was 5 years old.
Okay, it's growing so fast with such momentum. I keep forgetting just how young it is. But
yeah, we call it the Sustainable Business Network here in Portland.
Yeah.
But we are a chapter of the Business Alliance of Local Living Economies.
Yeah. Well, the national network is just a little bit older, but of course, the very first meeting of the national network was in Portland.
Yes, it was.
And but you know, I take great heart from the speed with which that organizes communities, and recognizing that that the local economy is an absolutely essential foundation of a strong community, and a strong local economy really needs to be based on independent enterprises that are owned by people who live in the community and who care about the values of the community and the quality of life of the community, which is very different from when you have an economy that is dominated by publicly traded corporations, in which the owners are totally absentee and there's absolutely no connection other than a flow of profits between the decisions of the corporation and the interests of the shareholders. So the whole Bali initiative, in one way, one way to think of it, is that it's an initiative to rebuild community by rebuilding responsible community-oriented economies. So that's one indicator. Now, I think there's another set of forces that are coming down on us that are going to shift the incentives very dramatically, and I see this getting attention everywhere and opening the possibilities for a new conversation. Essentially, it's what I refer to as the perfect economic storm.
Mm-hmm.
It has three key elements. The first is peak oil, which, as you know, that's the time when global oil production peaks and begins its inexorable decline in the face of rapidly growing demand, or continued growing demand. And, of course, now we have a major upsurge in demand from China and India. Now, we just don't have the capacity to expand oil production in response to that, because we're gradually draining the tank. Now, what that means is that prices are going to continue to skyrocket. Now, we've built a whole global economy around a premise of cheap oil, a cheap oil subsidy. And that's part of what makes it possible for big corporations to outsource. It's what makes it possible for us to project our military power out into the world to maintain control of resources and markets. And that all is going to start unraveling at a very rapid rate. Now, the second element of the perfect economic storm is climate change. And we're seeing a dramatic increase in the frequency of weather-related disasters, of which Katrina and Rita are just a kind of a foretaste of what lies ahead. Now, these severe weather events are going to play havoc on our long-distance supply lines, so long before the rest of the world tires of supporting an economic deadbeat, and particularly as other countries find their own food and energy needs growing, all of the incentives are going to be shifting away from long global supply lines to local supply. Now, you know, there's been a huge denial on all of these fronts until very recently, but I'm finding that, starting with more or less the middle of 2005, a real shift in consciousness that, rising